And the numbers are going up. We have a new variant coming down the pike just in time for the fall. So I've actually started masking up again. Actually, as a public service, I like to stay masked as much as possible. The people I meet on the street thank me for that. But yeah, there's a bad moon on the rise when it comes to Mr. COVID. He's coming back to spend the fall with us. So let's be ready, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, until that next booster hops out. Speaking of boosts, Brian Thompson Schmidt, welcome to WUSB Stony Brook. You are on the air.
Oh, thank you for having me on, Captain Phil. I'm excited to be here with you.
Yeah, man. And we have a mutual friend, Paul Levinson, science fiction writer extraordinaire. And I love Paul. He comes on every time I need somebody. I was like, Paul, here's the topic. Do you want to talk about it? Yes. No problem.
He's an expert. Instant expert.
Yeah. Just add radio. And then we're there. So speaking of being an instant expert, you put together that anthology, that robot anthology. Give me the title again. I don't have it up in front of me right now.
Yeah, it's Robots Through the Ages. I co-edited that with Robert Silver.
Did you work directly with Silverberg, or were you doing it like via like Zoom and email and stuff?
Well, yeah, it was all done via email and phone and all that because he's out in California. I'm in the middle of the country. But
how is he doing? I sat in front of Robert Silverberg during one of the Hugo Awards where Harlan Ellison won for Paladin of the Lost Hour. That's going back a ways.
Yeah, that is. Yeah, but I'm fine. You know, he's a little freaked out by COVID. You know, as you just mentioned, COVID coming back.
It's coming back.
He's really
visit.
Careful about. He's really careful about going out in public these days. Mm-hmm. He's had a few minor health issues, but he's doing great. I mean, he's 84, 85 years old.
My goodness.
He gets tired quicker than some of us do. But, you know, other than that, he's sprightly and he's still got a great sense of humor and he's just a pleasure to work with. So he's doing great.
We're lucky
to still have him around.
I mean, I don't want to get him mad at you or anything, but you got a favorite Silverberg novel or story?
Oh, yeah, we've talked about it a million times. My favorite is Lord Valentine's Castle. It's one of the formational novels for me as a writer and as a person. Lord Valentine's Castle has the most amazing world building, and it just swept me off my feet. It's funny. The funny story about that one I always tell is when I was a kid, I gave a Christmas list of all the things I wanted, and that wasn't on it. And my sister bought me that book because apparently somebody at the store recommended it. And I was like, I don't want to remember. This is crap. Yeah. Who's the Silverberg guy?
Who wants to read a story with the word Valentine in it, you know?
Right, exactly. So then I'm in my room for hours, and I'm sure my family wonder what I'm doing or don't want to know what I'm doing. But I'm reading this book because I just was so compelled. You know, a 14-year-old kid never comes out of his room. It was because of that book, and that was one of the first books that did that for me, and especially by somebody that I wasn't, you know, I was always reading the Star Wars books and the tie-ins, the things that I like, but I never, and you know, the old Star Trek novelizations that were done, you know, by James Blish. I read all that stuff, but this was the first time I was like, man, I really need to stretch my wings, and this Silverberg guy's amazing. I got to get everything he's ever done. So it's such an honor now, years later, you know, at 54, you know, 40 some years later, to come back and get to work with him. And I've worked with him a number of times, but this is the first time we co-edited.
Wow.
So.
And that anthology is such a great mix of classic science fiction and new stuff, of which Levinson's Robinson Calculator is among the newer stuff. But it's a nice mix. I mean, was it difficult to cut out some of your favorites? I mean, a book can't go on forever, right? Oh. So
That what we did was we divided the labor. Bob said, I'm going to cultivate everything before 1980 and you take everything after, and then we'll pass things to each other. So I had a you know, Google Docs folder that we could read, you know, PDFs of everything. And then I took care of the new authors, I mean the new stories, and Bob edited them after I looked at them. But I worked with, you know, we had Shannon and Ken Scholes and also Martin Shoemaker doing really great new stories for us. And then so basically He picked a lot of stuff. I picked some stuff. We really had a particularly hard time cutting some of the classic stories from the 50s because you know, there was just so much good stuff. But we ultimately, I said, you know, if we pitch this as a survey through the years, we can't just have half the book be 1950. We're going to have to 1950s, we're going to have to make some cuffs. So we made some tough choices. And there were things like Asimov just is really hard to get stories because they're owned by Simon & Schuster. And so they wanted basically our whole budget for one story. So we said, well, that's not really affordable for us. So, you know, that made it easier to eliminate some things. But yeah, it was, there's really a lot of good stories. That's the hardest thing was deciding, okay, you know, what are the things that are best choices for us, you know, because we want the best stories, but at the same time, we want a broad swath of kind of representation of you know, who has done, you know, how people look at robots, AI, and androids.
And, you know, speaking of the Asimov things, I think I brought it up to Paul as well. You could have titled the book Robots Except for Asimovs Through the Ages. Well, but Asimov's robot stories have been reprinted and reprinted over and over and over again. I think you did the genre a service by exposing them to like the newer works, you know, and even
I hope so. I mean, with Folded Hands is one of the stories that's in there, and that's a classic. That one follows the three laws. And Connie Willis had Asimov as a character in his story where he meets robots to follow the three laws. So it wasn't like he was left out. He was, you know, and Bob talked about him in his essay at the beginning, too. He was definitely there, and his three laws were influential. But you're right. I mean, he's widely available, and he's been in print so many times. It was nice to be able to showcase people who aren't always remembered, like Jack Williamson with Folded Hands and so on.
Exactly. So besides the anthology, you have a new book coming out, and hence the reason for this. This was a last minute thing. And I'm glad it worked out because I'm just coming back from a convention, and I didn't really have any plans for today except to try to be chill because we're still recovering from our trip over the past weekend. But I'm like, yeah, this could work. So, There's a series of books you're putting out. This is the first book around a character called Jason Max. These are Jason Max thrillers. Yeah. And this is book one, and this is Shortcut. And what's happening here is there's a mathematical genius, Jason Max, who figures out a formula that speeds up space travel. And his wife, Laura, disappears, and Jason has to go and find her. And so it's math to the rescue?
Well, basically, I mean, first of all, the theory, and we used real math and science to the degree that we did, but of course, when you're doing science fiction, you have to, you know, posit possibilities that aren't actually, you know, where could the science possibly lead as opposed to where it actually does at the moment? So we base the shortcut theory is actually based on a very interesting thing called polariton lasers, and polaritons are basically kind of microparticles. And basically, the theory is it's a theory of displacing matter from one place in space with an equal amount of matter from another place. So technically, if you carefully chart your progress, you can take the ship and everything in it and move it over and replace empty space somewhere else. And therefore, you can transport your ship at a very fast period of time, you know, within our solar system and even, you know, to other solar systems. So in our system, it would, instead of taking days or years, you might cut it down to weeks or months or even days, you know, even hours to get somewhere. That's the idea behind the theory. And polariton lasers are a real thing, and they're really doing some interesting work, but they're nowhere near this level at this point. But basically, he comes up with the theory that employs that. His wife, Laura, is an astronaut who went up on the space shuttle, and she also is a laser expert, so she helps him with some of the tech. They're one of the great love stories, so it's kind of an epic, lifelong love story, and then she disappears, and he's like, whatever I have to do to get her back, what can I do? You know? And so that's the great mystery. And there's elements of First Contact and other things as well. But I did a lot of research with, I went to, you know, JASA Space Center, and I did a lot of stuff with Voyager 1 plays a particular role in the story. And there's a lot of really cool stuff. But anyway, the idea, I should point out, came from a producer named Hunt Lowry, who was the producer of Donnie Darko, A Time to Kill, and a lot of really cool movies. And he had this idea for a math genius and came up with the character Jason and Laura and a few others, and then brought me in to help develop it as a novel. And so we worked together, and this is what we came up with.
So this is concurrently. So this isn't something you wrote and then shopped out to Hollywood and they picked up the option. This is something that you worked simultaneously and developed it. Sort of like Clark, like Clark and Kubrick for 2001.
Yeah. I mean, I spent a lot of time at the Warner Brothers studio meeting with them and on the phone and Zooms and all that stuff and all of this in from like 2016 through 2019. And then COVID hit and canceled our release plan. So everything kind of got held off. So, yeah, we did it together. And it was always he was going to keep the film rights. I would keep the publishing rights. And, you know, I got credit on the novel, but we share credit on the story and characters. So that's basically how it came out. But, yeah.
Our mathematicians,
it was an interesting way to do it.
Are mathematicians known for their Indiana Jones level or James Bond level of adventure? Adventurism.
No,
because it sounds like you know, he's going to put the hat on. He's going to leave the math class and put the hat on and grab the whip and go like Indy does in those movies.
He ends up going because he's the only one who can do maintenance on the shortcut engine if they have any problems getting there. Because there's a special engine that you install on the spacecraft that allows it to use to make the shortcut jumps. So he ends up going, but actually he gets injured and he has a lot of struggles. He has to go through astronaut training and they're not even sure he's going to be ready, you know. And so he actually is the least qualified astronaut. So, I mean, it's done realistically. It's done with, he's got a lot of abilities, not only in math, but he's done some inventions and he's actually a qualified master chef. And he's a pretty interesting Renaissance man character, but when it comes to being an astronaut, that's his wife's job. She's a pilot. She's actually flown spacecraft. So it's kind of putting him outside his comfort zone to go, but he does go along with another guy who is a former astronaut who goes. And anyway, it's interesting. They meet whoever's abducting her. You know, it may not be from Earth. And they don't know, you know, until they get there. And so it's that kind of thing.
So is our launch vehicle systems like what we have right now, current systems right now, sort of like, you know, the stuff that's going up, the independent companies, as well as the new NASA moon rockets, you know, and whatnot, is that, or is this a little more past that?
Well, no, there actually is a secret military space shuttle that the government has prepared. It's the X-39V orbital test vehicle. That's a real thing. And originally he plans to go up in that, but then he decides working with the government, that might not be in his best interest. So he calls in a favor and goes up on one of the SpaceX ships with his thing. So SpaceX is a part of it, a brief part of it, how he gets there. So one of the other things that was exciting for us, you know, when we were first writing this, it was like, okay, who's most likely to be the one that's going to be sending people, you know, as tourists? Probably Musk and SpaceX. But it wasn't like it is now. Like, just a few years later, here we are past COVID, and it's like a regular thing almost, you know? So it's funny how that the book got delayed until this point when it seems less far-fetched to say that. But basically, it's SpaceX. Long answer.
And once they get up, once they get into orbit, because these are all like low-orbit vehicles. Do these things have to be adapted? Because the shortcut engine you're talking about in the realm of the story, it's going to put them out in the deep space. So that's a different ball game than just, you know, close to Earth. It's like working without a net here. So do they change things up so they'll not fall apart outside the orbit of Saturn or something?
There's a special SpaceX module and some modifications that go and they go up on the... a special shortcut module and stuff that they say basically, you know, attach to or build and make part of the ship that goes up, and that part is the part that takes them out and they go and the part that brings them back.
She's okay. I mean, she's got enough oxygen and stuff to hang out while they're putting the rescue ship together and everything.
Well, they don't know for most of the book, but eventually they have reason to believe she's still alive, so they go out to try to find her.
And I like the idea.
At first, they think she's kidnapped on Earth. At first, they think like they got beat up in a park by some gang-like guys, And they thought that maybe they took her, but then there's all these clues. So that's part, I don't want to spoil it too much.
No.
That's part of the mystery is she alive and is she not? And how can they get her back? Yeah.
But yeah, because she's sending the messages from Voyager 1.
Yeah, eventually she does. Yeah. And lets them know. So
that's crazy. Awesome. So she manages to go. I mean, Voyager 1 is in a different direction than we always hear about Voyager 2, right? And then, in fact, didn't we just lose contact with Voyager 2 and they got it talking again?
We did.
Yeah.
Well, Voyager 1 has been kind of, out of the spotlight and basically lost in space for a while. So that's part of the mystery of it, is that all of a sudden it sends a message back and they're like, wait, well, what is this?
putting Voyager 1... So Brian, putting Voyager 1 back in the spotlight, co-starring with Jason Max.
I'll tell you what, when I heard that news a couple of weeks ago about Voyager 2, I was really glad it was Voyager 1. They would have killed my whole plot.
That's great.
For me, I'm a big space buff. I love all this stuff, like NASA and all that. Getting to go to Johnson Space Center was so cool, and I've been around a lot of different space stuff because it's just always fascinated me, and I've got a scrapbook of all the missions all the way up from my grandma started it before I was alive to all the way to the mid-80s with all the space shuttles. So I love space, so it was really fun for me to deal with all the aspects of that, but I also wanted to realistically deal with the physiological aspects. So a friend of mine used to be the flight surgeon he was the guy that approved astronauts to go off on the space shuttle. So he's a doctor. He gave me all this really cool information on that, and we dug into all that kind of stuff. So we tried to make it as plausible as possible, so that, you know, it was. I wanted to do hard science fiction because I really love that, and I was the first editor on Andy Weir's The Martian,
yeah,
which is another thing that people know. And I that book, you know, I know that Hunt wanted to do something that would touch in with that audience. So the difference is, we don't really get fully to space, at least on screen in the book, as you call it, until the third act in this book, whereas most of The Martian took place out in space through the whole story. But it's in the vein of that.
I tell you, going back to The Martian, man, when he lifts off the Martian surface and he's stripped down that capsule, you know, and he's taking, I mean, his ribs break, you know, on the way up. It's unbelievable. You know, it's just great. But I mean, we have a history of getting our, you know, not always, but of getting our people back. You know, looking at Apollo 13, and that movie had that whole vibe of that as well. Is this story? I mean, this is book one. Is this particular story completely resolved, or does it stretch over several editions?
Well, I would say that it's a standalone in the sense that there is kind of a sense of conclusion, but there's an open door for, okay, what happens next? Mm-hmm. That's the way it is. And there's a prequel story that talks about the science a little more that I did called Max Factor, people can check out. It's kind of up there on Amazon in different places. But basically, my plan is to do a sequel, but because of the movie contract, I'm not actually allowed to do a direct sequel until they either release a movie or give me permission. So I'm not sure where it's going, to be honest with you. I do have several ideas for shortcut novels and stories that use the technology, and Jason may or may not be a major or minor player in those. And I'm talking with them right now about how to do that. But first, we want to get this one out. But there are certainly a lot more stories in that universe, and that's why I called it the Jason Max Thrillers, because I'd like to do more.
So Jason may or may not become a Clive Cussler recurring character who does incredible things all over the world.
Well, yeah, he may not. He may or may not. But, you know, he may be just the guy behind the science, and there may be other people who are better suited, too. Because, I mean, like, it's kind of like the same thing. When people always, I always ask Andy, I said, how come you never did a sequel to that thing? And he said, it's because, you know, the guy's gone. He's gone through this horrible experience. It's questionable whether he'd ever want to go up again, let alone go up again. And how do you realistically, without it being silly, send him on another adventure, you know? It's kind of hard, and Jason may end up being the same way, but he can certainly help other people get up there.
Yeah, I mean, if there was a sequel to The Martian, if there was a sequel to The Martian, it would probably be like Home Alone 2, right? I mean, he just gets left everywhere.
It's a little bit like,
We left him in the asteroid
How
belt.
Are these people this dumb that they took this chance again, you know?
Well, and actually, you know, at the end, I mean, we're talking too much about the Martian, but in the end, you know, he's not doing so great at the end of the movie. He's walking with the cane and everything, you know, and it's had a real impact on him. Hey, you're listening to Captain Phil's Planet on WUSB Stony Brook. We're talking with Brian Thomas Schmidt. The book is Shortcut, a Jason Max thriller. If you turn on the Amazon.com machine and type in Shortcut, a Jason Max thriller, or Brian Thomas Schmidt, or just go on the WUSB.FM website and look up Captain Phil's Planet, you'll find a way to access this book, available in Kindle, in hardcover, and paperback. Available now, Brian?
It's available on September 15th, and then the audiobook is coming October 17th. Very excited to announce that Stefan Rudnicki and Skyboat will be doing an audiobook. It's already in the production right now, and it's going to be really cool.
So this is something you're collaborating on for eventual filming. Is the strike impacting any of this at all? Is this delaying things? Is this outside the confines of the strike?
Delaying everything right now. I mean, obviously we can't. I'm not heavily involved in what they're doing to make that happen, but they need to sell it to a studio and get money. And right now the studios aren't putting out a lot of money until they know when the strike's going to be over and have to figure that out. So then they can't sign any contracts with actors and all of that, which are part of, you know, getting important people attached is often how you sell it. So all of that is on hold right now. Mm-hmm. So the main thing we're all focused on is trying to, you know, let people know about the book and get people excited about the book so that people will want to see a movie. And then, you know, the movie can happen. But you know, he's been planning to do it for a movie, and it's a story ready made for that. So hopefully that will happen. But yeah, the strike's impacting everything, but it's important. I mean, it's important that writers get treated fair, and actors
Absolutely.
As well. And so all of that is, you know, is definitely in our minds. So I wouldn't anticipate that they're going to be announcing that they've greenlit a movie till probably sometime next year, at the earliest, but you know, you never know. I mean, things can happen. And I mean, they're announcing projects. Every day I'm checking IMDb, and they're announcing projects. And I'm like, how can they do that during the strike? There's all kinds of things in the works. You never know when it'll show up.
Yeah, exactly. So you have a lot of great credits. You've worked with a lot of different people. What was it like working with Mike Resnick? I remember Mike. He used to go to my bank of conventions around here. The king of anthologies. Later on in his life, what did you do with Mike?
Well, I call him my editorial father, because he really was. He was very supportive of me early on. Did a story even for an anthology that was very low rate, very small press for me early on, and really helped me out. Supported me. In fact, it's sad that we never got to do something together. We talked about it several times, both writing and editing, and just various things happen, and we didn't get it done before he passed. But yeah, Mike is a great guy. He was a mentor, he was a good friend, and I think the world of him. He's an incredibly talented writer, and I hope, you know, we actually wanted a story his, for various reasons it didn't happen. I wanted a story his in robots. He's got a lot of great robot stories, but for various reasons it didn't work out, mostly because we really needed to find stories with women writers, and we had to make a lot of choices because there were a lot of stories by men, but we really wanted to include women in our process, and so ultimately we chose another story instead. But you know, if we do a sequel to Robots, he'll for sure be in there. So
excellent. Yeah, no, I just remember Mike from back in the day. You know, there's a couple of people. Well, of course, Alan Dean Foster, everyone knows. Todd McCaffrey, son of A.M. McCaffrey, spent a lovely convention with him up in the Albany area. My wife, a huge A. McCaffrey fan, and Todd, such a great guy. But you've also done a lot of...
Todd is a great guy.
Go ahead.
If you like thrillers, go look up his book, City of Angels. It might not be in print anymore, but you can probably find a copy. City of Angels. I edited that book for Todd, and it's one of the hottest, coolest thrillers I've ever edited. It's set in Los Angeles, and it deals with AI and nanobytes and tech and all. It's a very cool book. It's a really great read.
And you've got a lot of work here with the character, the movie character, the Predator. So you have,
yes,
like Predator, Eyes of the Demon, Alien versus Predator, Ultimate Prey, Infinite Stars and Predator, If It Bleeds. So, did the Predator actually hunt you down for this project?
Well, no, I went after it. I was a Predator fan, and they were doing some stuff.
So you hunted the Predator.
I hunted the Predator. I was doing Infinite Stars with Titan. Infinite Stars actually is not Predator. It's a space opera thing I did.
Okay.
It's kind of like Robots Through the Ages. It's like a survey of space opera, really great space opera and military sci-fi. But I wanted to do Predator, and I wanted to do more tie-in stuff, and there was an opportunity with a new movie coming at the time, The Predator. And so I pitched it to Titan, and they pitched it, and Fox wanted to do it. And, you know, I'd already done enough anthologies. I was able to get really good names and people to do it. And they liked what I did so much, and the fans liked it so much, that they brought me back to do another one and asked me to work with Jonathan on the AVP as well. And so I'm still hoping to do more. I'm pitching novels and things, and you never know. We'll see what happens. But I've really fallen in love with the whole Yautja Predator universe. So we'll see. I might be doing something with aliens too, you know, so who knows?
Yeah, you know, I love the earlier Alien stuff. And, you know, I haven't really kept up with it. I think, what was that movie called? They went to this planet and they had the original
Prometheus.
Yeah. I had a hard time wrapping my head around that movie.
So did I.
Okay, no, good. That's why I couldn't even say the name of it. But I was really hoping, for a little more meat and potatoes there, you know, and not so much. I mean, Aliens, you know, the Cameron take on it was decent and fun, but I think we could have learned a little bit more, or whatever, you know. It just seems like that whole universe just so terrifying and so dark. And if you just look at the way corporations rule humanity, you know, in that world, that's frightening. That she's there, you know, she's there, and Ripley had to work this horrible job where her kid grows up to old age while she's out there, you know, in hypersleep or whatever it is, you know, and it's
yeah, you miss your whole life
out, yeah, there,
which is actually a realistic view of what it's like to go out in space. It actually is
heartbreaking though. It's just so awful, you know.
Oh, it is heartbreaking. It is. I actually had a story in one of my anthologies by a guy that, you know, there was a guy who was a pilot, and it was basically him coming back and revisiting his life over different periods and seeing his kids grow, you know, having missed 30 years or whatever. I mean, it was about the effect it had on him, you know, to have to live that life and make that choice, you know. But yeah, I mean, I think that was a powerful part of it. And she was in the, you know, then all of a sudden she's in this new, completely new age. She doesn't know what anything is. Yeah, it's a lot of interesting stuff. They skipped around a lot in the timeline, and they didn't work a lot on the continuity. And I think that's part of the problem with following it, because things kind of change with every picture. There's more of that, I think, in the novel. Some people try to tie a lot of that together, but it's definitely been one of the things. It's the same issue with Predator as well. One of the things I've tried to do is find ways to tie the different things to connect the loose ends, because I really like that.
I haven't seen it yet, but I heard, what was it called? Is it Prey? Is that the one?
Oh, man. Yeah. That is right up there with Predator and Predator 2.
Yeah, I hear it's fantastic. It's
amazing.
You know,
it's amazing. Yeah,
so I'll have to check it out. I really have to check it out. You know, my wife isn't crazy about these violent and scary movies, so I have to watch it by myself. But then I'm watching.
Well, it's almost like watching a Western. I mean, it's about Cherokee Indians.
Yeah,
and they have an encounter, and it's really mostly from the point of view of a Cherokee woman who is, you know, in her society, you know, not taken seriously as a warrior, but she wants to prove herself. I believe she's the chief's daughter, but don't quote me on that if I'm wrong. But anyway, she goes out on a hunting party. And ends up being the one who saves her people from, you know, the Predator, so to speak, or at least, you know, stands her ground with it. So it's interesting from that. And it's mostly from that perspective. There's very little from the Predator perspective. So, I mean, I think in that sense, it might be more accessible to people. I think that's part of the reason it's been so popular.
And I think that's a great thing about the actual property itself. You know, it's Predator. They've been flying here to Earth to hunt us for centuries. So you could drop a Predator story anywhere, you know, anywhere in our time.
That's what If It Bleeds was. my first anthology was all these different periods, like Civil War and Vietnam and all these places where predators might show up. And it was so, so much fun. I took a little different approach with Eyes of the Demon, but that worked too. And you know, it's that's one of the things about the franchise that I think it's underrated, because, I mean, they can literally take it anywhere. And it's fascinating to see the different ways that, you know, different creatures and different things that would interact with the predators. And part of the challenge, what's interesting about the predators is that predators don't want to win easily. They want to actually have a challenge of a hunt.
Yeah, so no, it's a duck hunt. It's a duck hunt for them.
They, the competition.
Yeah, they're not shooting. They're not going hunting the way Dick Cheney went hunting. You know, like, you know, let the bird out of the box, you know, like, and then you blow it out of the sky. They want a challenge.
Yeah, it's not like Indiana Jones when the big swordsman comes up and he pulls his gun and shoots him dead. They're actually looking to have a fight, you know.
www.brianthomasschmidt.net for Brian's website and blog. On Twitter, it's at Brian Thomas S. Facebook, facebook.com, Brian Thomas. And you're also on Goodreads. Go on Amazon. The book is dropping on September 15th, a little over, about 3 weeks away. So you can pre-order it now. You can have a hardcover or a paperback or Kindle, or you can order all three. Now,
please.
Brian, is there, I mean, can readers contact you through either Amazon reviews or your website? Can they write to you and request an autographed copy? Is that in the cards?
Absolutely. I'll send them in fact, they can do it with robots through the ages, too. I have book plates signed by me and Bob Silverwork, and I have book plates that I can sign and send you for your autographed copy, or if you want to buy a copy and pay the shipping and the cost and have me send you an autographed copy, absolutely. You can do all of that. Through the contact form on my website is probably the easiest way, but you can certainly, you know, DM me on X, Twitter, formerly Twitter, and on Facebook and Instagram and all that stuff too.
On X. On X.
Yeah, I know. It's hard for me to even say it because I still Twitter to me. It's always going to be Twitter.
Well,
it is what it is.
Well, you know what? I guess, though, if you're a Twitter user and it's changed its name to X, now we have all become X-Men. So there you go. It's a lifelong dream.
Yeah, hey.
We're all
well,
new mutants
cooler,
now.
Right?
That's great. we're all mutants now. My friend, we're just about out of time. Did I leave anything out before we say goodbye that you wanted to drop about the project or any upcoming works?
Well, I just want to remind people that there's also going to be an audiobook coming through Blackstone for a Shortcut. And that will be out October 17th, but the pre-order link should be up really soon for that. That's Stefan Rudnicki. He's a big audiobook guy, really, really successful. And so that's going to be really great. And other than that, I just wanted to thank you for having me on. I really enjoyed it, and I really appreciate
that. That's great fun. And I'm sorry I wasn't that prepared, you know, but, you know, I'm a science fiction fan, and I looked over your bio, and I said, we'll find stuff to talk about for sure.
Oh, yeah. Well, sure.
I think we did.
I appreciate it.
No, it was a
very interesting conversation. I enjoyed it.
A pleasure. And please stay in touch as more things come out, as this thing goes in front of the lenses. And let us know where it ends up, whether it be on a streaming service or in the theaters, wherever it ends up. Because it sounds like a great idea. And initially, I thought it was reminding me of Interstellar a little bit, but it's really not, you know. But there was the part.
Well, I think that's a fair comparison in some ways, because you've got the farmer guy that goes up. So I mean, there's the math guy that goes up. There's some comparisons to that.
Yeah, it was just like him going out and trying to rescue her in order to get her, you know, and. I'm just about at the end of Zoom time here, but my favorite description of Interstellar is it's a science fiction version of Monty Hall's Let's Make a Deal because of the three different planets.
There you go.
What's behind planet number
there
one?
You go.
Planet number two. Anyway, I digress. but I have known for that. Brian, a pleasure. Thank you so much. Please make your return to Captain Phil's planet and keep us posted on all things Jason Max and mathematics.
Absolutely.
And we never mentioned Rudy Rucker, the other great science fiction math writer. So I guess we have to come back and talk about him at some point as well. Maybe I'll have you on. I have a great mathematics professor who's in a progressive rock band I have all the time. Maybe I can get you in the same room and you can talk math to each other. That might be fun.
Well, we can talk, except for that I don't really know much math. But yeah, okay. I had an advisor. So.
Well, he could do the math on your next book.
There you go. All right, have a good one. Thank you very much.
Pleasure. Take care, Brian. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
WUSB Stony Brook.